Hello, today we are speaking with Colin Gownon, founder and CEO of Via. Welcome to the podcast, Colin.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, James.
Fantastic. So I suppose to start off, could you tell us a little bit about Via?
I'd be delighted to. So Via is a four-year-old startup. We're based in the Boston area. You know, our focus is really in the area of clean energy and software for clean energy. So we have a point of view that if you really want clean energy to be adopted, you have to make it cheaper and more reliable than any other alternative. We think data analytics can be super helpful around providing, you know, the more greater reliability and decreasing the cost of integrating renewables. But it's a challenge. And, you know, we have software that kind of solves a lot of the very, very common challenges. And hopefully we'll get to chat a little bit about some of those today.
Fantastic. And so what drove that initial decision to start Via those few years ago?
A few things. I had the very fortunate opportunity of sold a company in 2009 timeframe. I stayed a few years with the acquiring company. Through the couple of decades I'd worked, I had the opportunity to work with really great people. And a few of us came together and said, you know, what's the, around 2012 or 2013, and started to say, well, what do we think the next big thing is? And through that process, we sort of looked at big data and AI and machine learning. And those were all kind of themes that were coming up. And then, of course, you can't just pick, you know, a technology. We also knew some, you had to pick a market or an area. And we thought, you know, better to be a little bit mission-driven. We'd had the opportunity to be successful in our previous life. And so, you know, what mission do we think we could tie ourselves to, or do we think was important? And we thought that, you know, there's a lot of gap around the energy space. And, you know, a lot of people doing work, great work, and, you know, and pioneering work in lots of other areas. And we thought, you know, as particularly around power, distribution of energy and transmission of electricity, it's kind of an overlooked area in 2016. And we thought when we actually founded the company, and we thought, you know, we're going to have to do something about that. And so this is an area we thought we would focus in together.
Understood. And then thinking about those kind of co-founders you mentioned, what would you say the comparative advantage of the initial founding team? What was that comparative advantage?
Well, I think partly there is something about familiarity. So some of us each other almost at, well, today, now 20 years, you know, some of us only 10 years, right? So we have a group that have worked together. And so we kind of know a lot. There are some advantages just in terms of direct communication, right? So, you know, basically you can have very direct, there's no beating around the bush. There's no kind of like mincing words. You get a lot of stuff done a lot faster in that way. I think you also, you know, we tend to know each other's strengths and weaknesses and have kind of understood how to rely on, you know, each other for our strengths and know when to feel comfortable saying, hey, this is my weakness, you know, and we know each other well enough to be open about that and say, this is not, you know, this is not my area of strength and I could really use some help here. And sometimes, you know, in other founders, I think founding groups that can be hard to admit weakness. And I think the other is there's not really competition. We've been through multiple companies. Some of us have been through four or five companies together. There's not really a competition about like jostling for position or, you know, titles or roles or kind of, it's like, you know, I think that there's kind of none of that in the, you know, playing out. So I think that that's kind of some of the advantages of just a team that's worked well together for a number of years.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. I mean, I've talked to a lot of companies who have initial founding teams where, you know, one or more of the founders don't really know each other at all. And it's very tough to build those communication lines at the same time as building a company, right? It's,
yeah.
You know, you're adding challenges.
Exactly. I think that it's all, when you're founding, just starting out, everything's exciting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with people you don't know, it's like nothing, everything sounds great. And so, they're, you know, things seem like they're gelling. Really, you get to know people under stress. And the advantage of having worked with people for 10 or 20 years is we've seen a lot of stress. We've seen things, you know, good and bad. And we could, you know, had gone through those times together previously. And so knew, you know, enough about how we might react in different situations. And I think that, you know, you don't have a crisis of confidence, right? And, you know, later if, you know, under, when there are new stressful periods, you kind of know where you're going to end up.
100%. So thinking back to those kind of early days, what did the first 3 to 6 months look like? You know, getting that MVP out, who were your first users, all that sort of thing.
Yeah. So lots has changed in that period. And I think in the early days, we were really focused in the area of machine learning and AI to solve problems in the energy space. So we actually started by working with regulators. So FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, was one of our first, in the U.S., is one of our first customers. And I would say in total transparency, it was less about the software and more about solving the problem. It looked a little bit more like a consulting company with software kind of, you know, figuring out what software was the right software to put behind to solve these kinds of problems. So we, I think working with customers was one way of kind of defining, well, what problems and what's the best kind of configuration of software that we needed to and what kind of product we, you know, would be best here. And certainly, I think even today still, but in 2016, certainly AI was, you know, was still very much in a sort of custom mode. We weren't a lot of, oh, just use this, right? Here's a box. Good luck with that. Right? It needed a lot of handholding. So the first 3 to 6 months were a lot of, in addition to working with some customers like regulators, it was also a lot of client conversations. I think we did, we have a good CRM tracking system. Jackie Finn, who's our co-founder here, you know, runs our marketing group. And, you know, she was very insistent about us having a really good tracking system. So I think we did over 400 customer interviews or marketing sector expert ETs kind of interviews in the first year. And 440, I think, is the number. And so a lot of it was just customer discovery, just understanding what the market needs and doing some paid work along the way. So.
And as part of that customer discovery, so it's 440, you know, does people talk a lot about early stage startups and they have multiple pivots and really they're just trying to figure out product market fit. And so at what point in that year or longer potentially did you guys feel, all right, we found the real problem that we want to solve for and product market fit then came from that?
I would say it was probably, nine or 12. And I think, and there was a change, which is we started in this area of machine learning, AI, and we did that once and we did that twice. And then by the time we got to the third sort of attempt here at different companies, we realized it actually doesn't matter how good your math is or AI or machine learning if you don't have access to the data. The data was the problem. The data was trapped, was locked. You know, you couldn't get to it for a whole host of reasons. Sometimes because it was too confidential. Sometimes it was in too many different silos or disparate areas. Sometimes it was too big to move, right? You were gathering a lot of it and you didn't want to, you know, couldn't attach it to an email. And sometimes, frankly, it was just a hassle. It was, you know, not in a stage or format that was, you know, sort of machine learning ready. And so we started, you know, it was around that point, right? I guess it was only the, you know, shame on us, you know, we didn't get to it earlier, but it was only around the third or fourth time we started to say, hey, you know what, we should probably fix these other issues, right? And initially we thought if we fixed that, that would help our AI machine learning business. And what we realized then after we started to develop this platform to kind of fix these other issues, which is that everybody has these issues, these data issues. Data's trapped kind of everywhere in the world. And if we could solve that, that's actually probably even bigger. If we, enabling others to do AI and machine learning is probably an even bigger market than, you know, us providing some specialized algorithm on our own. So lots of, you know, quite a journey there over the last few years.
Nearly being like the shovel suppliers to the AI industry, right, over the next 20 years time.
Exactly. And in fact, applying, you know, applying AI to solve some of those problems too. Just so in the same way, I might say, Uber and Amazon are not just transportation and retailers, they're AI companies, right? They apply AI for those problems. You know, we apply AI for things like data cleaning, data wrangling, data security, all kinds of aspects, but not necessarily the final solution, which, you know, we can leave to others as well.
Understood. And so that kind of core product that was kind of focused on from around 9 months in, is that what you kind of now term TAC, T-A-C?
That's right. Trusted Analytics Chain is a platform that programmatically controls data workflows. So who uses data, when it gets used, how it gets used, how it gets transformed, how it goes from a raw format to something consumable by a machine or by a person.
Understood. And so what would, a concrete example of how TAC could potentially be used?
So a couple of real life examples. We have a large European utility. They have petabytes of data. Right. So this is, you cannot attach to your email. Even Google won't let you have an attachment that large. And they feel like they have good data science skills. They want to have better AI skills and data science skills, but it's actually really hard. They have in the utility industry, and you see this a lot, they have 6 open positions and only 1 filled. And that's, you know, good. The best data science people, you know, may not go to a utility. They might go to Amazon. So they made a choice, which is, hey, can we find a way to work with academics or consulting firms, or maybe even open anyone who's, you know, to be able to access their data and analyze it. In the ideal world, that would be great. But of course, there's lots of confidentiality issues and, you know, size issues. And so the basic core product that says, has a component that attaches to the data and a component that an analyst can use, and any kind of script that a data scientist or an AI person can write in Python, most common language for data scientists, they can, instead of getting access to the data, they basically send that to wherever the data is. It runs there and results get returned. That's kind of the high level. In between, there's a bunch of checks and balances to make sure the code you're writing isn't going to steal something. You know, the code you're writing isn't going to take too much compute time. The results that are getting sent back aren't revealing too much. There's a sort of audit element to make sure, hey, who's doing what when? You know, when was the data? Are you allowed to? So there are sort of all kinds of, you know, different checks and balances along the way.
Understood. And then in terms of the monetization of tech, is it based on, you know, the amount of data that's moved through the system or some other model?
Yeah. So today we offer it. So I think of us as still early stage in kind of how we think about the business and where we think the market is. Ultimately, we see a marketplace kind of evolving. So today we have a license system. It's an enterprise license for people who have data. So 100% of our customers are, you know, multi-billion dollar utilities, and they pay a fee for having an access to the system. And, you know, we don't charge the analysts anything. We don't charge those who want to use it. It's up to the company to decide who they want to have access to it. In some future state, and I think that future state may not be, it may only be next year, maybe 2021, right? Where we see sort of a data and algorithm market evolve, where, you know, if you can really provide, you know, the data for analysis without actually transferring it, then you can kind of rent access to your data. And there we see sort of a different business model kind of emerging, more based on the compute time. I think there are a lot of people who kind of believe in sort of selling data. I think that's a hard model in today's environment or without something like TAC, because essentially you send somebody a copy and then it's, you know, who knows what they're going to do with it, right? They can do anything they want. You'll never know, right? And so you get a sort of a one-time deal. And I think our model where you're using, essentially, you know what compute is being run is a little bit better. And we think, you know, it provides more control to the people who have data. And we think also it compute time is kind of a proxy for value of the data. So if you have a little bit of data, your compute time is low. You have a lot of data, it'll be more. If you have a simple question, how many transformers do you have? Or what's the average age of your wind turbines? That should be pretty fast to compute. If you have a complex problem, you want to train an image algorithm, that's going to use a lot more compute time. And so the value is kind of associated with that. So we see that as kind of an emerging model for as we go to 2021.
Understood. And so in terms of the marketplace dynamics, the analyst sits on one side, the utility supplying the data sits on the other. Is the vision that the analysts are potentially building businesses on top of utility data? And so the analysts are the ones who are actually seeking to where the money is, I guess, or is it the other way around, right? Where it's utilities are just looking for, you know, the best and the brightest to actually do the analysis on their own data.
So the good news is in our world, both are possible. Mm. So there's, you know, and, you know, I think about that, and the truth is, so I've been in technology almost 30 years. And the one thing I can say is, you know, technology is unexpected, you know, enables all kinds of use cases that no one ever imagines, right? So when Steve Jobs, you know, was promoting, you know, the iPhone in the beginning, he never imagined, smart guy, but I bet he never imagined Angry Birds, right? Or, you know, or any other, you know, number of...
He would have been furious. No, I don't.
Exactly. You know, Candy Crush, right? Whatever it is. Like whole, you know, billion-dollar businesses kind of built that you could not possibly imagine, right? With it. And I think that's true here where, you know, we have to... The goal here is to enable... Maybe that'll be app developers or analysts or consultants or governments or whoever it is says, hey, I'm trying to piece together some, you know, this data to improve some analysis on my own part or create some new product. But it could equally be the data owners or the, you know, the utilities who say, look, I've got a ton of data and I want to make that available to improve images I'm taking of my wind turbines and make sure my wind turbine farm is, you know, performing optimally or whatever the question might be that they have. And all these utilities have way more questions than they have resources to be able to go, you know, answer on their own. So And maybe it'll be some third thing we haven't yet thought of. Maybe there's some Angry Birds Candy Crusher equivalent. Yeah. In 2022, we don't know.
No worries at all. So in essence, because one of the big common problems with machine learning and those kind of ventures is the data siloing, right? And then a lot of companies that I've spoken to and even I've worked for will have amazing models, but their models don't improve like to the level they should because they're only able to improve the model on a single client's data set.
Yeah.
And so in essence, like, does this try to break through some of that siloing?
100%. So that the companies like Google and Facebook store all of our photos for free, not because they are kind and generous companies, but because they use that data for their image, facial recognition software or their image analysis software to improve the cameras, on their phones so that, they can, zoom in on the person, right? Have the focus correct. So they have better products because they have more data to analyze. And if we really want AI to help the utility industry, the energy industry, the clean energy industry, you have to have more data, which means you have to make that available in some way while keeping it safe. And so the part of TAC is that it's not just a one-to-one solution. So I did describe that sort of a one-to-one utility having a number of analysts that they want to, but equally, it can be multiple utilities who want to pool. So we have an offering right now with working with a number of global utilities. Vector in New Zealand is one of them, Hawaiian Electric in the US and others. And they have data about transformers. They have also, those transformers are being impacted by solar. Somebody like Hawaii has more, solar than anybody else in the world. Vector has a lot of electric vehicles. The goal is that they could learn from each other without having to actually aggregate their data, put it, they don't physically send their data one centralized place, and put it in one database. That data can stay separate. And yet, there's a federated way to be able to learn across those databases. And we see there are lots of places where we're seeing that kind of model. Switzerland is, as an example where they have something, little tiny country with over 600 utilities, right? It's a crazy, nobody has, to your point, no one, James, has enough, data in that world, right? So we're seeing lots of environments where that community actually can come together but they just don't want to send their data physically to one central place to do that.
And in many cases are often not even allowed to do so, right? Depending on regulatory requirements.
We have one customer who said they have two divisions, one in mainland Europe and one in the United Kingdom. And they said it takes 9 months to transfer the data from one unit to another. And by the way, it's like Mary, Queen of Scots did not take 9 months to go from.
Sure.
Like there's no reason, that this should take 9 months for the data to go. It's just, it's all of these regulatory, those concerns of what's actually blocking that transfer of data.
And so with that in mind, then, when, client shows an interest in TAC and what VIA is doing, what is a typical kind of timeline to get a client up to the point where they're getting real value? Because, again, I imagine the utilities in general are just moving pretty slowly.
Yeah. So we launched something actually at the very end of 2019 called the 30-minute pilot. And we thought this was kind of an industry first because so many, pilots, prototype, demos, they all take too long. And we said, well, what would it take? Let's think about this differently. What would it take to actually get real data, real results in 30 minutes? And so we create, an environment to do that. And actually, generally it only takes 3 or 4 minutes. The 27 minutes, ahead of time is, getting people sort of comfortable with the idea, and they have to go collect a little tiny piece of data on their own. And I'm sure digging around their files to figure out like what data to use takes them 20 minutes or 25 minutes. So that's why the total is 30. But we have that sort of free pilot that we offer where literally, here's what you want to do, which is for transformers, you're interested in benchmarking your transformer performance or condition against, the hundreds or the tens of thousands actually in our of readings we have in our database without having to actually physically combine your data. So we can do that in that 30-minute process. We have a sort of second tier where a lot of companies then want to go through sort of a 4-week evaluation where they want to actually, it sounds good. Now they want to actually kick the tires and there's often a little cat and mouse game where they say, you say you can't get the data out or, but what if I tried this? And it's like, well, try it, right? Let's, knock yourself out, right? To go try that and see how that works. And we find that actually, we learn some things during that process too. It's always, it's like, oh, we should fix that. That turns out that, and usually the thing I take heart in is when we do find something, it's like, oh, that's a clever trick we didn't think of. But, you know, usually it doesn't take more than a day or two to kind of like provide some patch and kind of make that work. But so, you know, we find fewer and fewer of those as we go through these kind of pilots.
No, 100%. Yeah, I come from a background where a 6 to 12 month pilot was like not out of the question. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, if you're talking about, well, 30 minutes obviously is amazing, but like even in the realm of weeks, I think is pretty rapid. Cool. And so just getting a bit of sense of the company as a whole. So I believe you have two offices, one in Somerville, Massachusetts, and the other in Montreal. What are the reasons for selecting those two locations?
Let's see here. So I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so it wasn't hard to pick something. And I had an office out of the multiple companies. I had an office in Kendall Square, Cambridge for over 20 years. We moved to Somerville. You know, this particular area we're in is only 500 feet from the Cambridge line, which, you know, so we're close to Harvard and MIT in Cambridge, but it's frankly, it's 1/4 the price in rent and twice the space that we had in our previous office. So convenience and location. And it turns out Somerville is also a big energy, clean energy startup space. So there are, I think there are something like over 200 clean energy startups in Somerville within a, I'd say, 1.5 mile radius of where we are. And then we have a second office, as you say, in Montreal. We like Montreal because, which is really where our technical center is. And we like it because it has a big AI center. So I think a lot of people don't realize that AI actually fell out of favor in the 80s. You know, it was kind of considered a backwater and nobody really invested in it. And except the Canadians who kept going investing in it, and which is why Montreal became, you know, when AI came back in favor, it's like, well, it never left. And so there's a huge center there. And I think from having run a global company before with 2,000 people and 18 locations, Montreal is in the same time zone, so that's really easy. It's a 4-hour, 40-minute drive with one stop. I know that drive well. It's a simple drive to get there. It's, in addition to having great talent, it's also relatively cost-effective. So we get all of those advantages in these two different locations.
Understood. And then, you know, you're moving, I suppose, with COVID, like a lot of companies moving from a, you know, office, yep. even multi-office kind of model to something probably more fully remote. What does that transition look like? And especially around, I suppose, the culture of the company.
So in a way, you know, our VP of product the other day, Jesus, was just commenting how we seem to be more productive than, you know, in a way. And I said, yeah, that's probably because one, no one's on vacation. Two, no one's sick, thankfully. And three, no one has anything else to do. So that trifecta means you got sort of a big bump in productivity over the last few weeks or few months while people have been working remote. I do think it takes work to get that to be efficient. So I'd say we learned a lot of things that, you know, all meetings start on time. And you see people kind of like actually show up the 1 minute, 30 seconds early or 1 minute early to make sure that, you know, because that's important. And video is essential. And, you know, on our Slack channel, everybody logs in the morning and says welcome, and everybody, you know, says goodnight at, you know, at the end of the day. It's an important part. So there are little things that kind of, you know, to make sure the culture stays cohesive, you know, every day. And I think that takes a little bit of work. There's also the little things like virtual pub night and trivia night. And we hired there are now startups that are doing virtual trivia nights. And we hired for $150, we hired one to run one the other day, because that's, you know, that's what we kind of need to do in this odd environment we're in.
So. Speaking to that, so I recently worked at a fully remote company across like all North America. And there was a company we found that would serve everyone a pizza at the same time within 20 minutes, anywhere they were. And all you do is just put in all the addresses.
And I want to look.
We got like 21 out of 22 pizzas, basically.
Oh my gosh. That's a great service.
Yeah, I'll send that over to you afterwards. Cool, fantastic. And so I was broadening out, you know, in terms of outside of VIA, you know, one of the things a lot of people are talking about is as we move into a world of, you know, more stressors from climate change, et cetera, one approach is to decarbonize by electrifying everything. You know, think through, what are the main opportunities for potential founders in a world of like a 100% electrification?
Well, I think, you know, I come from a world of data and analytics, so I'm going to have a bias, which is in a world of complete electrification, you know, there's a world to optimize, you know, the power consumption. So you see this, and to learn from each other about like how power consumption varies in the world. So in Japan, for example, so we have TEPCO is one of VIA's early investor, Tokyo Electric Power Company, and You know, one of the issues they have is you have solar panels, you know, you want to put on the roof, but first everybody's close together. So it's hard to put, you know, so you don't get much solar, you know, power out of a very tiny panel when you have smaller homes. And everything in Japan, because power has been super reliable, everything consumes gigantic amount of power. The televisions, the rice cookers, right, the refrigerators. And if you go somewhere else, you go to Kenya or parts of India, and it turns out, because power is expensive, the exact same, a 27-inch television does not use the same amount of power in Kenya or India as it does in Japan. And so if I, you know, what are the opportunities for an entrepreneur? It's saying, well, how do I take everyday items and make them low power? Because that helps everybody, just generally finding ways to reduce the load, right? I think is kind of one of the big opportunities. So pick your favorite object that you kind of know well and like, that could be air conditioning or rice cookers or refrigerators or dishwashers or, you know, or cell phone chargers, whatever it is. And how do I make that faster charging, smarter charging, low power consumption, right? You know, there's hundreds of opportunities kind of in that environment. There are lots of others. I think batteries are the other big, why we're, if I were better at chemistry, right, or if I were, I think that's kind of one of the big opportunities where battery storage right now is we basically overproduce electricity in lots of ways. We just don't have a way of, you know, a convenient way or cheap way, enough way of storing it, you know, when we do need it. And, you know, being able to create that time arbitrage around power, that's going to be actually the thing that I think will make clean energy and reduce the overall power needs in the world.
Understood. And then thinking through, as you know, everything moves to electricity, hopefully we are getting more efficient with the power usage of those types of products, to your point. What are your thoughts on like the increased risk from cyber attacks in a more and more connected kind of power grid?
Yeah. So unfortunately, that's, you had a house with a few, you know, with a door and a lock, and now you've got, you know, you've built a glass, you've got thousands of windows you built, and it's easy to break in when that happens. I think the famous example of the Target, when they had their, you know, the retailer, when their, you know, the big breach they had on millions of credit cards happened by someone getting in through an air conditioner unit, right? That was basically they hacked through that, or there was a casino that got hacked through I think they had a fish tank, and the fish tank had some kind of online thermometer or, you know, meteorological thing. And that basically, you know, ran, you know, was the way in. So the more devices, the more potential kind of, you know, openings there are, smart meters, right? All those things. And I think it is a real concern. And I think you're starting to see people kind of say, you know, they're less concerned about, you know, when I grew up in the 80s, you know, thermonuclear war was kind of, you know, that was a real possibility. I think more people are worried about hacking the power grid today is a much more likely scenario, any kind of, you know, other kind of threat that you might see. So it's a real thing. The thing to do is not just, you know, cybersecurity will keep up with some of those, but I think edge processing will be kind of the way to deal with it. It's, you know, so don't move the data. Right?
Sure.
Don't allow it to be a window, right? Do as much processing on the edge as possible, and you minimize some of those risks. So that's I think some of the ways, you know, keep it fragmented and distributed is one way of kind of making sure, you know, of dealing with some of those threats.
And you're also building speed into the system if it is distributed, because it is sitting at the edge as well. And so you can even leverage it for the advantages that model gives you.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well said.
Thinking about, I suppose, other kind of, you know, hot words in tech, I suppose, what are your views on things like blockchain as applied to, you know, the clean tech space?
Yeah. You know, we have a small blockchain component we use to basically, it creates the audit log, and the immutable ledger, right? It basically keeps track of who's supposed to, you know, we have a smart contracting function that basically, you know, this is how you know who can access what data when and for what purpose, and then tracking, you know, the usage and, you know, what data was used at what point in time. You know, we never saw really the big sort of coin opportunities, you know, that a lot of others did, but the idea of this kind of decentralized database infrastructure, right, and auditable ledger, like that makes a lot of sense, especially in a world where you need technologies that are, you know, where that are beyond trust, where I don't know all the parties, right? So in a power grid where you know, I have a manufacturer of a vehicle that's electric, and I have a charging station by somebody else, and I have a, you know, the electricity powered by some distributed generation site by a third party, and then a grid that connects them. And, you know, all of those things are, you know, they may not know each other. So they need trust to be able to kind of know what's happening when, and, you know, they'd be able to have some auditable trail around that, makes sense. And so we see a good use for blockchain in those instances. I think of it a little bit like, I remember the mid 90s, I had a company and we were starting to build all of our applications using, you know, as an internet browser based. And I remember a client saying, yeah, but why? I mean, you know, Windows 3.1.1 is already has like a lot of widgets, and, you know, then it would be native to Windows. And, you know, why do you want to go to this browser based thing? You know, it seems so, you know, seems so weird, so arcane to do that. And it's like, because that's where the future is, right? Because the technologies that are going to, you know, for all the reasons you can imagine, but basically we saw a world where, and which happened pretty fast, that in 4 or 5 years, all of the development in that area became so much faster because it was open source essentially. And, you know, that you had a lot more tools available to you in that world than you did on any single sort of environment. And I think that we're sort of seeing that as well in the blockchain, you know, world where, you know, things like homomorphic encryption or, you know, just decentralized compute or all kinds of, you know, tools are actually becoming much more available and growing at a rate faster than any single company can kind of, you know, build a new database or around. So
no, that all makes sense. I suppose changing a little bit to more of kind of your kind of backstory, you know, I'm a big believer about, you know, where you're kind of grow up deeply impacts people's approach to things. Can you tell me a little bit about kind of where you grew up?
So I grew up a little bit everywhere. I was born in Canada. I grew up in Scotland. I went to school in 12 different schools around the world, and from Scotland to, you know, the Middle East to, you know, California, a little time in Australia. And I think that influenced me certainly in a lot of different ways, which is, you know, you become more open to lots of things. You kind of realize the world is filled with very different people and you have to adapt quickly to sort of stay alive. And you also have to, you know, be respectful of others, right? Because there's huge diversity and what you think is normal may not be normal to anybody else. I remember going to school in Scotland at a point in time where I remember the first day of school meeting somebody and saying hi to them. And hi was just not hello in those days. Like that was a very North American thing. No one else in the world said hi. Say, you know, as a greeting. And I remember it's like, okay, well, that's what you learn. Like you the world, so you learn to adapt. So being respectful and open, I think, is probably the number one lesson that kind of comes from that.
Yeah, I actually had not quite to the extreme of 12 different schools, but not a dissimilar background. And one of the things I found was at the time, you know, wasn't easy, right? When you're a teenager, you're just trying to figure things out. But I think in hindsight, you definitely started to notice, like, you know, and ask the question, why are things like this, right? And these are exposed to a lot of situations where it's like, why?
Yeah.
And people, it's part of the, you know, the water people are swimming in, so they don't really have a good answer. Sometimes they don't like when you ask the question, you know?
Right, right. It is that, well, I think this is an age-old question. I think Voltaire wrote Zadig, right? And it's the foreigner who comes to the court and asks all the questions about, like, why do you have all of these odd, you know, behaviors and rules and standards? You know, it's like, it's an age-old kind of, you know, impression, question that happens. So the outsider that comes to, has more perspective about why we do things than others. So.
And I think you even see that maybe reflected in, you know, the number of immigrants, not just in the US, but around the world who end up being startup founders, right? Because again, they're coming in and seeing whether the emperor has clothes, et cetera. You know?
Right. Things could be done differently, right? Exactly. And I'm afraid to say, yeah, I could probably do that. Probably naive too, right?
Yeah. I mean, that naivety is also key, right? Because otherwise you never start anything. You'd be too risk averse.
I have a story about that where I was in my early 20s and it was my first startup, mid 20s, I guess. It was my first startup and I, you know, cash was tight and I showed up at the CIO's office at this bank to, you know, to kind of try and get them to pay for something. And, you know, I didn't have an appointment. So I just, in those days, you didn't need security. So I could walk right in. So I got up at 7:30. I walked in, got to his office, waited at 8:30 or something. His secretary showed up. So like, do you have an appointment? I'm like, nope, You're just here. 9 o'clock, he shows up. He said, okay, you know, I guess I was there. So he took my meeting and I asked him, like, you know, would he sign the contracts? And he said, well, no, I need, you know, approval. And I need to, you know, I'm like, well, what can you sign? I must have looked desperate, right? So I finally figured out how he could sign one thing. And I said, great, when can you pay me? And he said, well, our normal terms are like 30 or 45 days or something. And I'm like, no, you have to do better than that. And he says, no, we just have, you know, I can't do that. We don't have the money. We don't do that. And I said, you're a bank. You know, you definitely
you have my money already, you know, kind of like,
yeah, like you can for sure. So I got 7 days terms, right, for every invoice. But there's no way I could do that today, because I know that's not how business operate. I know about net cash and, you know, all of these things, just, you know, I know how things work. But I got away with it then because I just didn't know any better. And he knew I didn't know any better. So which is why he's kind of forgiving about it.
Exactly. And because, like, if you went in for the second time, you know, they could see the kind of fear in your eyes, right? Like, because they know that, you know, but when you have that naivety at the beginning, it makes complete sense. Cool. And so, I mean, you mentioned a couple of times some other kind of companies you're involved in. I think you founded Grail Research and Conduit. You know, thinking about those, like, how has your approach to, you know, founding and leading companies back with those other companies, how has that changed? Or are there any things that you've explicitly avoided when founding and growing via?
I think lots and lots of things. There are lots of things that I'd say are sort of consistent, but always evolving. So one sort of consistent thing that, you know, that we are always iterating on, though, is about people. So really doesn't matter how good the technology is or what technology field you're in. Technology is invented by people. And especially in the technology space, there's always somebody out there who will make a better thing, right? Pretty fast if you don't. And so you've got to be, you know, get people who are committed and motivated, and especially for anything to scale, it has to work beyond you, right? So really doesn't matter what I think in lots of ways. It only matters what other people think and how they can kind of, you know, if they're aligned in that process. So for something to scale and be sustainable and to work even when you're not around, and especially in the technology world, that's hyper specialized, right? So even something like software, people, you know, deployment skills versus, you know, QA kind of skills versus AI skills versus database skills, those are all very different things. And those people are not kind of fungible and interoperable. Like, you know, if at the highest level, I mean, I think we have 11 patents we filed in the last 15 months. Like, you know, those kind of people who are kind of innovative, they don't, you know, they know their stuff and they don't actually know other stuff, right? Because by definition, they got deep in one area versus broad, right? They're not generalists. And so I think the focus on how do we get people to kind of unlock their creativity and want to do the best that they can every day. And so that I think has kind of been a sort of a, the way to do that is also evolving because people are also different today than they used to be. So I think that there's lots of like a little lessons in that world.
And is that kind of the primary lever that can be used at the hiring point or throughout the kind of the building of certain values within the company over time?
End to end, as you say, from day one, like even when it's just two people and being consistent about that. And also consistent goes always, which is this isn't here are the rules for everybody else, but you have to model all of those rules yourself. And for everybody, you know, who you expect to be a leader in the team, you have higher standards for the leaders than you do for others, like in making sure that's, you know, that's consistent. And the screening process is super, super important. I mean, one thing we do is we give little case studies, you know, whether you're an office admin or a developer or DevOps person, you have different kinds of case studies that everybody gets because it's easy to, you know, anybody can be charming and, you know, on a 45 minute call, right? Or in a meeting, actually see, you know, are they interested in the work? Can they pay attention to detail? Can they kind of follow the instructions around some kind of assignment? Are they committed to it? And you get a sense of, we have a value, which is love in, love out. If you love what you do, it'll show in the output that you have. And, you know, you see that in the assignments, right? The people who don't care too much or, you know, don't get them right. And the people who love, you know, really love coding, it's like, oh, they caught something. They actually thought about this way more, right, than we did probably in lots of ways. And so you see that kind of show. So we do it then and then all the way through, yeah, we have a 3-month probationary period, generally 3 or 4 months, depending on the, you know, role. And we want them to, some people will say, well, you know, I got the job or not. And other people are like, yeah, I take that bet. I bet I'm going to be great. You know, that's not much of a leap you know, and generally the best people are the ones who are willing to take that bet on themselves. So we, and there are probably 50 other little things that we do along the way to keep people motivated and try and attract the best people we can.
But that's, yeah, those are all kind of great tactics to kind of build that sense of, you know, internal, you know, vision towards the same kind of end goal. I suppose just here before we finish up, is there anything that I should have asked you about but did not?
I think you actually, yeah, that was a pretty good list of questions. I'd like to, you know, give a shout out to everybody at the VIA in Montreal and in Somerville. And as I said, you know, you can't do this. It's not the Colin show. It's actually, I just happen to be the guy who gets, you know, asked to go on the podcast or available to do it while everybody else is hard at work. So happy to have the opportunity to speak to you today and share a little bit about what we're doing and about the mission towards clean energy. So.
100%. Yeah. And it's, you know, super valid mission, something I think I'm definitely passionate about and ever more people are passionate about. Thank God. Right. It's been a while.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Cool. Very good. So thank you, Colin. I really enjoyed our conversation and wish you and all of VIA all the best.
Thank you very much, James. Thanks very much.